marrying our existing expertise in decarbonization and infrastructure, it's a perfect partnership.
I completely agree with Larry. This is going to be the golden age of infrastructure investing, both in terms of the need for capital as well as investors who want that capital. Okay.
In a move that's raising alarms across the nation, BlackRock, through its 2024 acquisition of Global Infrastructure Partners, or GIP, has surged into direct ownership of U.S. energy infrastructure.
BlackRock, one of the largest asset managers on Earth, which owns just about everything, appears to be quietly buying up huge pieces of the U.S. energy grid. But don't worry, they say it's all about building infrastructure for artificial intelligence, so don't worry about it. Nothing to see here.
Shifting from passive investor to hands-on controller of critical utilities and grids.
The company BlackRock that's f***ing everybody in America, they're going to be buying utility companies now. That's right, utility companies. They've already purchased an electric company up in Minnesota. You. They have plans to invest hundreds of billions of dollars into the utility market here in the United States so you can watch your electricity and gas bills go up to nosebleed levels.
The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission approved a $6.2 billion takeover of Elite, parent of Minnesota Power, by a BlackRock-led consortium with Canada Pension Plan in October of 2025, granting private equity majority control over power serving 150,000 customers.
This $6.2 billion deal follows months of debate and pushback from groups across Minnesota.
It is not always going to be in the financial best interest of BlackRock to keep our rates as low as possible. That's not the business that they're in. They're in the business of making profit from as many things as possible.
I'm a Minnesota Power customer. So if you have read stories over the years about beloved brands like Joann's or Red Lobster being driven into the ground by private equity, now imagine if that was your utility, because that's where private equity sector is going, as they have extracted all of the value out of the retail and service sector that they can. They are increasingly turning their attention to infrastructure and the things that make up the material basis of our lives.
Meanwhile, GIP is in advanced talks for a potential $38 billion acquisition of AES Corporation, which is a major player with renewable assets nationwide.
Ares' team drafts the game plan for restructuring portfolios, valuing toxic assets, and bailing out collapsing banks. Larry Fink had turned the greatest financial disaster of a generation into his greatest triumph. While American finance takes years to rebound, he emerges with friends in high places, more money than ever, and what he's always wanted, the influence of a president, a company like a world power, without a single campaign nor a single vote, true power. And while no one was taking notice, he has created a playing field where, no matter what, BlackRock always wins.
Thousands of miles of overhead pylons will be erected to connect offshore wind farms, solar farms, data sheds, and millions of cars and other renewable sources to that national grid.
In Texas, BlackRock's footprint grows via GIP-owned firms like Eolian, developing massive battery storage projects such as the Padua Complex near San Antonio to stabilize ERCOT amid retiring fossil plants and exploding AI-driven demand.
Blackstone is currently in the process of purchasing the Texas-New Mexico grid. BlackRock actually started under Blackstone, and while they still claim that they're separate now, if you look at their yearly reports and their quarterly reports, they still push the ESG narrative. The Texas Attorney General here has a lawsuit against BlackRock for that very reason, where they were manipulating the grids and pushing solar and wind technology and offsetting coal and oil and gas because of them pushing this ESG narrative.
Consumer advocates and experts warn of profit-driven models loading debt onto the utilities, slashing accountability, and hiking residential bills to subsidize big tech clients, eroding public oversight of essential infrastructure serving millions, and private equity prioritizes returns over resilience. John Bound reporting for InfoWars.
Challenging all of you to support the broadcast, keep us on air while you get great products, and it's a win-win. We need funds, we are in the red, and we've got to be able to continue our legal battles. We've got to be able to continue to buy new product going in the future. We've got to continue with the funding to build the Alex Jones backup network in case they're able to shut us down. I cannot do it without you. So now is the time to go to thealexjonesstore.com and do your final Christmas shopping there. Anywhere in the United States, if you order by Friday, you will get it before Christmas. So get your orders in now. Do your Christmas shopping with us, but really give yourself the gift of health with our creatine gummies, the highest quality type of creatine, 5 milligrams. That's a daily serving per gummy. Huge container of them. Such a great deal. This is the best creatine out there. There's so many other great products and a whole bunch of other sales and deals. You can become a subscriber right now on any product, cancel any time, and it reorders every month and get 50% off on all future orders. The widest selection of t-shirts, hoodies, ball caps, sweaters, many of them limited edition at thealexjonesstore.com.
You're listening to The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at x.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, joined today by Kevin DeAnna. He is a prominent writer and commentator on immigration, identity politics, and American nationalism. He hosts the Identity Politics podcast from American Renaissance, where he provides sharp analysis on cultural and political issues facing the historic American nation. Find Identity Politics on Rumble and Odyssey. Follow him on X at VDareJamesK for daily insights. Kevin, welcome to the show, sir.
Harrison, real pleasure to be here, man.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. You run probably my favorite Twitter account of all time. You're definitely in the top five. And so I'd been following you for a while. We finally met at a VDare event, and then I got to see you speak, and it was mind-blowing. It was really something else. So I'm glad that you're putting your face and your voice out there now. Tell us about Identity Politics. What made you want to start this podcast?
Well, for a very long time, I was obviously working under different pen names over the years because I've been doing this for about 20 years now. And there were things that were possible 20 years ago, working in the conservative movement, trying to infiltrate it and turn it in the right direction, where it made sense, where you were basically leading sort of a dual life. Mm. You're working at like the Leadership Institute or whatever Conservatism Inc. thing during the day under your real name, and then you're writing for all these websites under a different name. There's no point in doing any of that anymore. I think that one thing people need to understand, especially young people who are coming into this movement at the first time, is you are going to get doxxed. There is a 100% chance that it's going to happen. There's no point in sneaking around. Just own it. Real face, real name. The stakes are high. We now have a mass constituency. There's no point in sneaking around anymore. And one of the things that made me want to start Identity Politics is writing is just not the way to reach a younger audience now. People don't read these kinds of long-form essays. People want to do streaming. They want to do debates. They want to see videos. They want people to be speaking on the issues that are happening right now. And I think you would agree that there's a real difference between Gen Z and the younger millennials and the people who really built the conservative movement that we're sort of dealing with right now. Young people understand that their country is being taken away from them. In many ways, they don't even know what it's like to have a country. Right. If you're below 30, you just have no idea what that's like. But the older conservatives, they're completely unaware that this transformation is taking place. And so I really wanted to say something to the generation that's going to have to fight to reclaim a country that was taken from them before they were even born.
Yeah, and all of this is they're just fascinating aspects to the sort of political transition that we're going through right now, where people are less afraid of just coming out and saying what we all know to be true: white people are being destroyed, and that's evil. Why has it taken so long for this truth to come about? Like, it seems so obvious to people like you and I, and you've been in this longer than I have. Why was it so long? Why was it so forbidden to talk about this stuff? And what do you think has caused the Overton window shift to such a degree? Is it all Trump? I mean, it can't be all him, right?
Big part of it. It's a big part of it in the sense that if you are below a certain age, the only political era you know is the era of Trump. which is crazy when you think about it. Because if you're like a millennial, you remember like George W. Bush.
Right.
You remember Mitt Romney. You remember John McCain. I mean, in many ways, I think a valid criticism of older people, including me, is that we're too easy on Trump because we remember how bad things were before.
Right.
And so when you have Trump, you're like, oh, this is so much better than what existed before. And so you're not hard enough on him. But the big thing that's really happening, and this is something that I think people only under 30 or under 35 really understand, is there's nothing to lose anymore. There was always – you had some skin in the game if you were older American. You had some sense of wealth. You had some sense of property. You had some sense of investment in the country. If you are young and white, you have no stake in the country, none whatsoever. If America wins a war, if the GDP goes up, what difference does that make to you? And increasingly, your leaders are very comfortable in telling you – you're going to be replaced. We don't care about you. You have no skills. We're going to bring in workers from the rest of the world. You're not suitable to our needs. There's any retreat or any place of safety has been totally cut off, which is the one thing Sun Tzu says not to do in the art of war, right? You got to give your enemy a place to run to. And young Americans are being left with no place to run to. So they have no choice but to turn around and fight. And the demographic transformation, even in just the last 10 years, has been so remarkable and so drastic that one can't help but notice it. We're in a totally different country than the one that existed even in 2015 when Trump came down that escalator. And while Trump has done a lot of good things, not least stopping, for all intents and purposes, illegal immigration without passing amnesty, which of course all the conservatives said was impossible for years, he has failed to stop or let alone reverse that demographic transformation. And now we're looking around and we feel like foreigners in our own land. And unlike these other people, this is the only country we have.
Right. And even if we wanted to go back, you know, I'd have to go back 400 or 500 years before I found my family in Europe. But it's not like Europe exists in any real way either.
No. I mean, you hear this if from the old days, you remember going to like immigration demonstrations and stuff, and you would see these people waving foreign flags, screaming at you things like, go back to Europe, go back to Europe. Well, we can't go back to Europe. One, because as you say, it's already happening in Europe. And two, if we did go back to Europe, they would just follow us. That's the problem. We're not allowed to have any place that's really our own. And I think that's the biggest thing that a lot of young white Americans are looking for, this idea of ownership, the idea of a country that belongs to you and only to you. I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy just published an article in the New York Times criticizing Nick Fuentes and really a kind of strawman version of the Groypers, where he was saying, oh, well, what is an American? An American means believing in certain eternal principles of free speech or limited government or these types of things. Well, there are a lot of Americans today who don't believe in those things. And more importantly, this idea that American identity is universal and that everybody on earth is a potential American, the founding fathers didn't believe that. So is George Washington not an American, but somehow Vivek Ramaswamy is? This is what is being sold to young Americans, and increasingly they're looking around and saying, we don't buy any of this, and they have nothing to lose, and they have no authorities that they're bound to respect, and certainly no people that they're expected to owe loyalty to that shows loyalty to them. So why don't they want to burn it all down? That seems like a very reasonable thing to do. The danger for the right, of course, is that so many of these people, if they're not given a real alternative, they are going to go in for the sort of socialism that is being provided by the left because they figure at least we're being offered something.
Yep. And that is, I mean, all these things are the arguments that I've been making for years at this point, it seems, where the older generation, I don't get what their problem is in understanding this. That, like, if you are listening to young people who are, in some cases, you know, TikTok videos, it's a trend now, especially young women crying in their cars going, I cannot afford to live. How am I supposed to live this way? And the conservative boomers just go, ah, well, screw you. And it's like, what do you expect these young people to do? They're going to go to the people who are sitting there going, hey, we know how you feel. And it's unfair that you're treated this way. And see those billionaires? We're going to go take their money and give it to you. Obviously, that's going to be who they're going towards. Not that they're right, not that their plans are intelligent at all, but at least they seem to care. At least they seem to be offering something. What is it about the boomers that they just – are they willfully ignorant to this? Do they just not care? Because it seems like even if it's for their own ego or whatever, you know, Ted Cruz types – they're going to like kill you if they get back in power. How are they?
Right.
How
do you not see this? I think there are three things taking place here. One is that most people just don't change their mind about anything after age 25.
Right.
More or less, that's just how it is. More or less, the world that you look or you see when you're young is the world that you always kind of see. To some extent, I think this is even true of Donald Trump. He still fundamentally is a creature of the 1980s when he was arguably at his height. I think he still looks around and thinks it's still the same country, as the same America of the 1980s. And that's not really true anymore. The second thing I think is a product of the conservative movement itself, because we are talking about like boomers in the conservative movement that run a lot of these institutions. When you have an ideology that tells you the single most important thing to do is to pursue your own material, economic, individual self-interest, what kind of people do you think you're going to get into the movement? How can you be surprised that you end up with all these traitors and time servers and people who just want to go into it to be corporate lobbyists, who aren't willing to sacrifice, who aren't willing to work for their constituency, who are basically looking to sell out at the first opportunity? And the broader point is a bit more subtle. People don't like acknowledging that they are benefiting in some sense from a rigged system. But the fact is, if you are part of the asset-owning class in this country, specifically housing, the market is skewed in such a way that you benefit from it. But you don't want to be told that you're benefiting from a skewed system. You want to tell yourself that you earned this, that you got this through hard work, that you pulled yourself up by your bootstraps or whatever else. But yeah, that is true to some extent, but really you were able to buy a place at a time when it was still affordable, and now you have a high inflated home value really out of sheer luck. I mean, certainly, even for like older millennials like myself, buying a house feels like getting the last chopper out of Nam or something. You were just able to do it before COVID made everything go nuts. It's not because I was so amazing and brilliant. It's just because I lucked out. But people don't like acknowledging that a lot of their material success comes from luck. Now, for younger people, and I think this is also true post-COVID, which just destroyed social trust as a society. I mean, I think that one of the big things that really happened to us is that people started looking around and realizing that all of society seemed to be run by a kind of scam. The way you get rich is by knowing people in the government, by getting contracts, by defrauding programs. And the idea of working hard and playing by the rules, I think, has been totally destroyed for the younger generation. And that's not because they have a bad character. It's because the older generations, to some extent, failed us.
Man, we need to do like a weekly thing with you or something, because everything you're mentioning, I want to delve into for like a couple hours, because I feel like we should and could, and that there's a spiritual underpinning to all of this that you're kind 100%. Of hinting at, that, you know, the idea that you would, you know, refuse to see the truth because it interferes with your own ego. There's something like deeply narcissistic about that. And it actually is humility to be able to say, look, I just got lucky here and I want everybody else to be lucky. And I have like an article to point to for everything that you're talking about. I was going to bring up the Vivek crash out, the yearly tradition now.
It's a yearly tradition. It's a Christmas miracle. This is just what we do now. He has actually ironically answered the question, what is it to be an American? It means celebrating certain holiday traditions like the Christmas tree and going to Christmas mass and having Vivek crash out on the TL. That's part of what it is.
You like the Yule log, you pour the eggnog, and you watch Vivek.
You sit back. And you go on X and watch this Indian dude crash out.
Yeah, and try to jam himself into Heritage America. And I mean, but you know, what he's pointing at is a central sort of conflict in politics for the last decade or so. What is an American? What does it mean? And it's so insulting.
That's the most important question.
It's so insulting to me to have somebody who he's literally an anchor baby. And I like Vivek. I like 90% of his beliefs. He's wrong about this, and it's insulting. And I don't know how he doesn't understand how insulting it is for real Americans whose families have been here for hundreds of years, who built the country, who have nowhere else to go, who don't benefit from the immigration programs that his family has, to then be told by him that you have the wrong ideas because you're not American. It's absurd. But I had the same thing with people like telling me I shouldn't be friends with, or, you know, shouldn't be on the same side with Charlie Kirk because he's a Zionist. And it's like, how do we get to just that core central American identity that says, hey, we might disagree on stuff, but at the end of the day, me and Charlie Kirk are on the same team, whether we even like it or not. How do we get to that point, or is that what we're going for? How do we deal with this conflict that Vivek's yearly crash out helps to illustrate?
Well, there are a couple of big points there. I mean, one thing, obviously, with Charlie Kirk, with the assassination, the big lesson that everybody should have taken away from it, and which people only did for about a second, is that, like, look, you're all the same to these people, and they want to kill you.
Yes.
Many of our little disputes really don't matter to the people who do matter. And the people who do matter are those who are willing to seize state power and use it. Leftists are willing to use power. Right-wingers just talk about power. That's like the big lesson on that. So we should have a certain sense of charity to the people on our side, even if we disagree with them, because the side that you're on is not really up to you.
Right.
It's up to power, and power is coming after us. As far as the broader question as what is American identity, I think what really bothers a lot of white Americans, especially white Americans of, say, my generation, which was, I think, the last one where you were told that to not be racist is to be colorblind. And then they changed it later, where if you're colorblind, now you actually are racist. But nobody my age or younger certainly was taught that white identity is a good thing. It's either something that you shouldn't care about at all, or it's something that is actively bad. But the problem is, and so we all grew up believing this, and we all grew up to some extent practicing it. But then you look around, and everybody, the same people who tell you that blood and soil nationalism is so bad, they all seem to have a special exemption for the people that they like. Even Dinesh D'Souza crashed out about India a few weeks ago, Mr. Radical Individualism, so he didn't really believe it. Obviously, when it comes to Israel, a lot of the people who say that, well, America is just a question of ideas, suddenly there's a special exception for Israel. Certainly, a lot of these people who are in Congress, who are shilling for the interests of illegal immigrants, are very proud to say, I represent this Latin American country, I represent that Latin American country, I represent this constituency, but America is just this marketplace. Right. It's just this land of universal ideals. Anybody can believe in it. And by the way, even if you don't believe in the ideals, we don't get to kick you out. So you don't even, nobody even really believes that either. And I think what white Americans are basically a fair people. And I think the reason so many people are reacting against this, and whether that's going to lead to a movement to reclaim American nationalism, or whether it's going to lead to maybe a different form of identity altogether, comes down to the fact that everybody seems to be a blood and soil nationalist for the people they actually care about. And that's not America. Whereas we are told we are not allowed to be dedicated to one particular thing. We are not allowed to have a country that belongs to us and only us. But we are supposed to allow everybody else to claim both America and the nation that they really care about. That's unfair on its face. It's a double standard. And even though it's kind of cheap sometimes to be like, imagine if the shoe was on the other foot, people notice double standards. And people are noticing this. And that's what they're reacting against.
You know, it's literally every day. I feel like my audience has me sick of it, but every single day I say that, where I'm like, I know, we're doing the thing again where we say, imagine if it was the other way around. But it's like these things happen. You know, the big article that is still viral, I mean, it's still at the top of the trending list after like 4 or 5 days, the Compact Magazine article about DEI. And it's like, yeah. How did nobody see how weird and wrong and sick this is, that you had people in boardrooms just openly going, yeah, no more white people? And it's like, okay, can we please all imagine if this was the other way around? Because through the decades of propaganda and the, you know, a lifetime of programming, it's been like, it's like there's a little node been implanted in everybody's brain where it changes how they perceive the same thing twice, right? If I say the same thing about black people, no alarm bell goes off. If I say the same thing about white people, the alarm bell goes off. And that's been implanted in people's minds. And I'm trying to surgically remove it, and I can't figure out how. How do we get people to just be able to see things objectively? Because I think that's all it takes. I don't think you need to be a pro-white person. I think if you just look at it objectively, you'll see all of the things that are bad that are going against white people, and you'd be against that if you were objective. How do we get people to take that view?
Well, one of the interesting things about that piece in particular, I think Jeremy Carl on his Substack had a response to it, where he pointed out that even that piece understates the problem to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, really what that piece is about is like liberal whites working in like media and elite fields who suddenly got discriminated against. If you were a conservative American, or if you worked in the trades, especially if you're a blue collar American, doom was coming for you decades before.
Right.
And nobody spoke up for you. I mean, remember, like, learn to code. That was what they told you.
Right.
Now it's a problem because these people are being told to learn to code, and not even learn to code, because H-1B workers will take your job there too. What really we're talking about when we talk about identity, and this is something that, again, I don't think a lot of us are particularly comfortable with, a lot of it is unchosen. And a lot of it's not just a question of like how you're born or genetics or something like that. Sure, that's part of it. But what I really mean is how power treats you. Like, if you are treated as a white person, and that determines whether you get to go to a school, whether you get to go to a job, how your colleagues view you, what issues you are and are not allowed to talk about, whether you like it or not, you're white.
Yep.
And what we have in this country now is a very complicated caste system that is gamified by certain protected classes who simultaneously claim to be oppressed, but then use that supposed oppression to get very real and concrete financial and professional benefits over everybody else. And arguably, that's what success in America is determined by more than anything else today, whether you can get yourself classified as one of the protected classes. And we have heard over and over and over again, and then this goes back to what Vivek Ramaswamy said, this is what Tucker Carlson said the other day when he was saying, well, we don't want to go in for white identity. We need to go in for colorblindness, universalism, meritocracy. I mean, this is the default position of the American right, right? I'm sure a lot of the audience are nodding along, being like, yeah, that's all we want. But the problem is the very same people who say these sorts of things always want a special exemption for their group. And you begin to wonder after you've seen this for enough times that did anybody ever really believe in universalism? Did anybody really believe in meritocracy? Because when it comes down to the policy level, we're not actually seeing competition or the most qualified person getting hired. What we're seeing is basically ethnic cartels moving into companies and taking care of their own.
Yep.
And we don't have to like that.
Like, right.
Objectively speaking, if you look at like Pew Research polls, fewer white people think their race matters as a core part of their identity than do other groups. That's just a fact.
Yep.
But weirdly enough, that means that believing in individualism and universalism is basically a white thing.
Exactly.
As counterintuitive as that sounds. And that also means that if you're in an environment where everybody else is playing the identity politics game and you're not, you're just food for everybody else and your values don't mean very much.
100%. And you're talking about patronage networks. Of course, democracy in a multicultural world is just a racial headcount. And I've tried to make the joke before. It never quite lands on X, but exactly what you just said, where if you're a white person who hates white people, well, white people are the only race that hates themselves. So you're ironically doing the thing that makes you – it's like the most white right. thing to do, actually. So if you're against white people,
yeah.
you shouldn't be against white people because only white people are against their own race. It's confusing, but it just shows how nonsensical their whole mindset is. And we've seen the charts where it's like – races grading other races, and white people are the only ones who grade themselves worse or don't like mm-hmm. put grade themselves higher. Not even necessarily that it's a good thing that other races do, but they do. And then white people are constantly the ones who are told we're racist. And that's where it really gets me, where it's not just that,
right.
oh, they value themselves and we value ourselves and somehow it's bad. And we don't, put ourselves in the, prime spot. They do, but we're the bad guys. It's not just unequal. It's like completely inverted.
Right. And the problem, of course, is this has real political, not just political consequences. I mean, we all know that. And I think it was William Crystal, of all people, who said something along the lines of, we don't have elections anymore. We just have a census. Of right. course, I don't think he'd be very favorable if we took that to its logical conclusions in terms of policy. But even something, things that like really would affect your life, say you go into a courtroom, say you get ensnared in the legal process. Well, what determines whether you're going to win or whether your life is going to be completely destroyed? Well, it tends to be the racial makeup of the jury.
Right.
Polls have shown that every single group has a bias for their own race in these sorts of things, except white people, who have actually something of an anti-white bias because yeah. they have this concern with fairness. I think a critical mistake that we make is, just as a matter of history, it was white people who founded this country, who set up the institutions. And when people talk about the rule of law and when people talk about universal principles or civic nationalism, there's this understanding that everybody views the world the same way that we do. Mm. And that is not true. The other people do not view the rule of law as a thing that you have to obey because somebody wrote these rules down
yep.
and we all have to play by the same rules. Other people do not agree that that is moral, or they just think it's foolish to behave that way.
And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We got to go to a quick commercial break. We'll be back in a few minutes with Kevin DeAnna, Amarin.com at...
Ladies and gentlemen, Nitric Boost, the all-time fan favorite, is now back in stock at InfoWarsStore.com. You've looked at our formula. You like it?
I did, and I do. Yes. Well, nitric oxide is a key. It's made by our own bodies again. It's made by L-citrulline and L-arginine, the amino acids.
And now a major shipment has finally come back in for those of you that want to be able to stock up on it at InfoWarsStore.com. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Judy Mikovits, without me even knowing she'd gotten it and used it, came on years ago and said, this was the best spike protein detoxer she'd found.
Just like you want your own body to make vitamin D from the sunlight, you can't force it back in people who can't make it. It can actually hurt them. It's called peroxynitrites. So you want to boost your own body's ability. The nitric oxide relaxes the endothelium, the vasculature. It relaxes the vein. So I use the two, your InfoWars. I keep that on my shelf, and I feed myself the Cardio Miracle, which is just for straight food. It's a different formulation than that one, and the two together are a 1-2 punch. So you get in your food the ability to make what you need and no more.
Because of the organic-based compounds that are in it that cause vasodilation in the blood vessels, in the arteries, in the veins, in the capillaries. And it just does so many other great things.
So constricted blood vessels too, because athletes are running, they're constricted, they're working so that the blood flows and it doesn't flow, which is why your nitric oxide product, that new product, I hope you'll show it, because that's a very important thing to have for acute events. Dissolve under the tongue, give you an instant relaxing of your endothelium, your vasculature.
Now listen, it is already a nationwide best-selling bodybuilding product for over 20 years. Bodybuilders take this and helps grow muscles and better workouts and things. I was just researching and wanting to put something out that was good for the heart and talked to a lot of scientists and researchers I knew, and they said, well, these are the type of ingredients we were thinking about putting out a product. When I talked to formulators, they said, well, we actually already have a product that has that, so we private labeled it as Nitric Boost. And just for men in the morning when you wake up, that's the big thing people feel and see right away. So imagine what else is doing for your body. So for those of you that love Nitric Boost, it's back in stock right now at InfoWarsStore.com. And for those that haven't tried Nitric Boost, you are really missing out. Secure your Nitric Boost right now at InfoWarsStore.com. We're battling in the courts. We're still here a year after the Onion said they bought us. We might actually hold on and win. But regardless, the shopping cart's there. The shipments are going out, and you will get your product. But if you don't order it, support us, we'll be off the air. So it's a paradox. So please take action now at InfoWarsStore.com and experience Nitric Boost for yourself. And listen, men feel it in that one way. Women love it as well. It's good for men and women. Get your Nitric Boost now, right now, exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. And thanks for being the reason one way or another we'll always be on the air. InfoWarsStore.com, Nitric Boost, back in stock.
The Great Reset. Eat the bugs. You will own nothing and you will be happy. Take the vaccine. Trust the science. Get your booster. Every crisis is an opportunity and the world will be reshaped in our vision. Down with the globalists. Get ultramethylene red at thealexjonesstore.com.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
I love those J-I-N-G-L-E bells. Oh, those holiday J-I-N-G-L-E bells.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room, InfoWars.com. Remember to go to thealexjonesstore.com. You know, everybody knows the reason you call Black Friday Black Friday last weekend of November is when most stores actually go into the black. They're in the red for most of the year. They go into the black at the end of November and make really most of their profit in Christmas time. And that's stores that all they do is sell things. That's all they do. InfoWars and thealexjonesstore.com is a store that sells things and also powers this incredible media empire that we run. So we're under even more of a constraint than most stores. So near at the end of the year, if you're watching Alex earlier today, you know, we're still in the red a little bit. We really need your help to make up that shortfall and go into 2026 fully loaded, full tank of gas, ready to hit the ground running. We obviously are putting everything we have into this. All that we ask is that you give us the fuel that we need to continue our operation. Go to thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison to let them know who sent you. Take advantage of the absolutely mind-blowingly huge sales we have continually at thealexjonesstore.com. Get yourself a supplement that can help you to achieve your goals in 2026. Don't let those New Year's resolutions sneak up on you. Make sure that you have the supplementation you need to physically be able to do what you plan to do. TheAlexJonesStore.com, 60% off all products. That sale ends very shortly, so make sure to take advantage of that. And with that, I am again happy to be talking to my guest, Kevin DeAnna, prominent writer and commentator on immigration, identity politics, and American nationalism. He is now hosting a podcast called Identity Politics from American Renaissance. You can find that on Rumble or Odyssey, Identity Politics. Follow him on X at VDareJamesK for daily insights. And again, you know, if you watch War Room and you're listening to Kevin now, you'll not have any problem identifying that we are very firmly on the same wavelength on just about everything, including the creeping lack of morality due to immigration. Business Insider has even identified this from an article a few days ago. United States of fraud. Americans are stealing and committing small scams at an ever-increasing rate. And, you know, there's all these things. It's like, the test scores are collapsing, trust in society is collapsing, scams are exploding, fraud is exploding, and they want you to believe that this is just some sort of bizarre natural phenomenon that the American people have decided on a whim and altogether to just start being more criminal. I think it has a lot more to do with the changing demographics than anything having to do with the change of the American, you know, mindset. Although, if this is the demographic that's coming in, if we start becoming more like a third world country, then Americans are going to have to, you know, change themselves to comport with that. Because if everybody else is screwing each other over and you're not, guess who's going to lose? So, Kevin, what do you make of this phenomenon of just the ever increasing deluge of fraud that we're seeing a lot of times, specifically from migrant populations?
Oh, 100%. And a lot of it is also downstream from COVID. I mean, think of all the fraud that came from the PPP program. You see a couple indictments, but I mean, we're talking billions of dollars that we're never going to see again.
Tens of billions.
I mean, it's insane when you look at the scope of this, and then you look at what's happening in Minnesota with the Somalis and everything else. The problem, it's twofold. The problem, one, is that we have a legal system that is not set up to deal with groups that have high in-group preference, that do not rat on their kin, that do not believe law enforcement is legitimate, that are going to set up these kinds of scams. There's no way to penetrate these things all the time. I mean, even in Minnesota, you're seeing that because the Somalis have been culpable in all these cases, that is why the Democrats in that state are defending them so fiercely. You actually see people doubling down on saying, and that's why we need more of them. The worse they behave, the more they need to be defended, because that shows how much more oppressed they are. And the second thing, of course, is that to go back to the structure of our economy and everything else, and this goes to immigration in terms of the fact that the rule of law has just been completely abandoned. This even, I hate to sound like a libertarian somewhat here, but this even goes to the question of big government. The only way you can make money at this point is to have some sort of a deal with the state, which means having political connections, which means having deals with contractors, which means having deals with all these sort of ethnic political mafias that run the show in a lot of these states and localities. When you look around and it seems like the only people who are making any money are the people who are running some sort of a scam or have some sort of a connection with the government, it's pretty reasonable to conclude that I better do this too.
Right.
And if you're one of the people who thinks like, well, I believe in a high trust society, I believe in honest dealing in business, I believe in earning your own way, that is not the culture that we live in anymore. And in fact, the system is set up to make sure people like that can no longer succeed.
And isn't that just terrifying? I don't know. I find that terrifying because I can just see the feedback loop and nobody seems to be trying to interrupt it. And it is a very delicate thing that we have here, a high trust society where you can go and, you know, try to file the paperwork to start your small business and you know that the clerk isn't going to demand an extra $100 bribe on top of it. Like, that can go away so quickly. And then it's just a completely downhill greased slope. There's no coming back from it. So I really worry about that. And you sort of hinted there at another thing that I first heard you say, and I don't know if you came up with it, but it's something that you tweet out a lot, which is The purpose of a system is what it does. When you have a system whose outcome is continually the same thing, even if it's negative, the only reason to maintain that system is because you want that negative consequence. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, especially how it intersects with immigration and Somalians and the high crime rate and all that?
Right,
the purpose of a system is what it does. It's a brilliant statement that can be applied to just about every negative consequence the government or NGOs or industries do now. Explain that statement for us.
Well, I think that a lot of these policies may have started out of naivete or misplaced goodwill, but there comes a certain point where a deliberate refusal to understand constitutes a moral crime. And I think we've reached that point when it comes to the consequences of immigration. When you see over and over and over again these populations being brought in, and they're not being brought in organically because they're good for the economy, we, the taxpayers, are funding these refugee resettlement groups, which then provide them with all of this aid. So one, it's already artificial. But then when you see the ethnic crime networks, when you see the larger street crime problems, when you see the problems of political corruption, when you see all of these horrific cases of illegal immigrants drunk driving, killing Americans, crashing into people, they don't have the right licenses, in many cases even these truck drivers, they don't have car insurance, even medical care, they just go into the hospital, get taken care of and leave, and then we have to foot the bill. When this happens again and again and again, I simply don't believe people who say, well, this is all an unintended consequence. At a certain point, this actually is the intended consequence. And when you think about why that might be, what has been the story of America that you have been taught for longer than we've been alive, 50 years? This country was founded on racism. This country was founded on sexism. This country was founded on the genocide of the American Indians and the exploitation of black slaves. White people kind of have it coming.
Right.
I mean, I remember something that Louis C.K. said, and I think he meant it as a joke, but you begin to question how many of these people don't really mean it as a joke, where he said, life is so good in America, and that's a bad thing. And we need to bring some people here to kind of bring it down to everybody else's level. I think there's a deep-seated guilt that a lot of people feel because we have this society, this very fragile, high-trust society, and they sort of feel we need to deconstruct it in order to make it fair for the rest of the world. And if that means imposing suffering on the larger masses of Americans, well, then that's just what we have to do to be a good person. You see this certainly when it comes to criminal justice, where I think it's very clear that the purpose of a system is what it does. Over and over and over again, we are now seeing people not with just a few arrests, not with just like 10 arrests, but dozens of arrests for serious crimes being let go. And who could expect it? They then kill somebody, or they're being tracked by the government. You know, they've got the monitor on their ankle or whatever else. The government doesn't bother to do it. They go off and kill somebody. And what happens? The judge lets them go. At a certain point, it's not, well, I'm naive. I think they deserve a second chance. I think it's about compassion. I think it's about this, that, or the other thing. No, they see it as something justified against the larger white society that in some way they feel needs to be punished. And if you think that's an extreme way to view the society, go to any history class at any university in the country, go to any anthropology class, go to any sociology class. I mean, my red pill was just going to higher education and realizing how much the average college professor hates your guts and wants you to suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. And you know, a couple things you've said have reminded me of Orania and the story of Orania. This idea that, like, okay, there's a nice, lovely little, you know, community that these people have built. They haven't hurt anybody. They haven't exploited anybody. They didn't colonize anybody's land. But just their existence as a nice example of a well-ordered life is unacceptable to people that aren't in it.
Right.
And so you've got South Africa now threatening to destroy it. And that goes back to what you were talking about, young people growing up now and realizing there's no escape. There's no, oh, if you don't like it, go build your own thing. If you go build your own thing, they will come and destroy that too. So once you accept that and go, okay, running away is not an option, giving in, submitting and trying to go, okay, all right, we're the bad guys. That's not an option either. There's no bottom to that, you know, pit that you're throwing yourself down. So, you know, a lot of this, I think, comes to a head in Orania, this free state in near South Africa, is sort of this emblem, this icon of the trouble that white people are in the world over. Can you expand on that a little bit and just the idea that, like, there is no escape, so it's time to reformulate the plan here?
one of the most remarkable things when you talk about Irania or you talk about any of these sorts of communities that have had a little carve out, a place of civilization and sanity away from everything going on, is how militant the language against it is, how graphic it is. These people need to be killed. These people need to be raped. We need to inflict this kind of suffering. They're not actually doing anything. And the question has to be, well, why do you even care? Like, I'm accused of being racist and all these things, but it doesn't particularly bother me that there are like dozens of countries in the world where blacks live. Like, I don't care one way or the other what they do, like, other than like vaguely wishing them well. But the mere existence of something like this will drive people to homicide. And the key here is they feel righteous about it, which tells us that there's something else going on here. I think the delusion of egalitarianism as in and of itself a moral good is something that needs to be ripped out by the root. To have a free society is to have an unequal society. And if left to their own devices, people are going to form different kinds of communities, different ways of being that are not going to be equivalent to each other. And some people are going to build societies that are better to live in than other people. And if you want everybody to be equal, you are going to have to destroy those better societies. Africa, of course, is a great example. I think one of the most tragic cases is Rhodesia.
Yep.
Rhodesia was a country, unlike South Africa, did not have apartheid. Rhodesia was a country that in many ways was quite successful, but the United Kingdom and the United States spearheaded an effort to destroy it, made sure that it was not handed over even to a moderate black leader, but it was handed over to Robert Mugabe. I think InfoWars itself has done a great deal of reporting on the years about what happened in Zimbabwe there.
Yep.
And now Zimbabwe is a basket case. Everybody's starving. Life is objectively worse off for blacks as well as for whites. The whites have all been basically genocided. But nobody learned anything from it. Nobody in the United Kingdom or the United States said, hey, guess what? We were wrong about this. Maybe we should have rethought some of the policies. Maybe a system where it leads to objectively worse outcomes for literally everybody was the wrong thing to do. Everybody still feels morally righteous about it. This is the danger, is like we're all Rhodesians now. We're all Iranians now. And there's no point anymore where you can move away and sort of opt out from what's coming. And this is also one of the most important things about the conservative movement. I think the goal of a lot of people in the conservative movement is to get to a certain point, sell out, quite literally sell out, make enough money, move to a suburb somewhere, put up the gated community or the picket fence, and then just sort of ride out the storm. Because one of the points I make over and over again is your average person in the RNC, your average person in the conservative movement, they see what's coming. They know how this movie is going to end. There are no illusions possible anymore, but they don't care. Right. They think they can get eaten last. And what I would say is that the scope of demographic change and the anti-white radicalism that now defines the global left means that no escape is possible. And I think young people understand this.
They're sort of forced to. I mean, they're literally living it every day. I mean, they go to schools where they're minorities and they get treated, worse than you can imagine. And I was actually going to ask that exact question next. Related to this article from InfoWars, we've seen Rhodesia. We know how this ends. Veteran political analyst warns mass migration complex will destroy Western civilization if MAGA doesn't win. This, of course, is an interview with you. And my question is, how do we intercede? How do we – because we know – like you said, we know how this ends. We can see the trajectory. We have to consciously interfere and change the trajectory that we're going. And it should be easy to us because we should be able to point to examples like Rhodesia and South Africa. A lot of people expect there to be a giant crash. A lot of people are waiting for some sort of solar vortex to take out the electronics, and then we'll get the reset that we're looking for. I see the future as much more like South Africa or Rhodesia, where it's a slow degradation that can go on for decades, but eventually the power's going off, the copper's being ripped out of the power lines, you're being raided in the middle of the night, you got to live with barbed wire and automatic machine guns around your house just to survive. And in that case, we still have people in South Africa, they're still Antifa, they're still like leftist.
Right. Right.
Railing against white supremacy. So it's like people need to accept that we cannot just keep going in this direction. There is no bottom to it. We just keep degrading forever. How do we intercede and change our trajectory?
Well, I think we've talked about a lot of blackpilling things. I mean, let's talk about something optimistic. If you had told me 15 years ago that perhaps the greatest beacon of hope in the Western Hemisphere would not be the United States of America, but would be El Salvador, I would have laughed in your face. But right. Here we are. Right. Bukele shows that a single guy with a little bit of willpower actually can turn the entire trajectory of a country around. Now, the reason I think he was able to do what he did in El Salvador, and President Trump has basically been unable to do this sort of thing in the United States, is in many ways our prior success makes it difficult for us to get things done. You talked a little bit before about how our bureaucracy here is relatively non-corrupt. You don't have to like pay a bribe to get out of a speeding ticket, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in many ways, it's because we kind of have a sort of efficient bureaucracy, that we have these professional – we have an independent judiciary. We have these professional institutions that file lawsuits. We have a robust civic society and a free press and all these kinds of things. These are now the things that are getting in the way. Mm. These are the things that are preventing us from doing the needed reforms that we all kind of know have to take place. Bukele was able to just go in there and do it. Trump does not have the power to do these kinds of things. Leave aside the question of whether he has the willpower, and that's a separate debate right there. But even if he did, he can't just do it the way that he could in El Salvador, because you've got kind of a hollow state. We're at a point now where the state is so vast and the system we live under is so all-encompassing that it is questionable about whether any reform is even possible. And that is where you end up in a truly revolutionary situation, because revolutions occur when everybody knows the reforms that have to take place to sort of save the larger system, but too many people are benefiting from the way things are to allow those reforms to take place. So the stakes just keep getting higher and higher and higher until the whole thing fragments. That is what I think we're moving toward in this country, because I think it's a dangerous assumption to believe that swing voters or young voters are looking for moderate solutions.
Right.
I think they're looking for an extreme of one form or the other, and which way they go is basically up for grabs. It is extremely possible that somebody who was militantly for Trump last time is going to be a socialist next time. Or, frankly, that somebody who's a socialist in the last election is going to be what they call far right next time. It's just a question of who's willing to present the actual solutions to these problems and who is saying, I have the will to do these things, regardless of what the letter of the law says. Because we're at a point now where, let's face it, I mean, I think the rule of law ended about 20 million illegal immigrants ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where you get the anarcho-tyranny that comes about, because our bureaucracy is so efficient and so good at doing what it wants to do, it just never wants to do anything for us. And this goes back to what I think the first thing that we talked about was the fact that young people growing up, young white people growing up especially, understand we don't have a government really anymore. There's this there's this corporate entity out there that has the ability to rob us at will, and we call that the government, but in terms of a group of people that we have empowered with our votes to serve our interest does not exist anymore.
No.
And that is infuriating, because everybody else seems to have this, and they have international groups, and they have, but white people and white Americans in particular, our own government doesn't even support us anymore. And so it's like we're looking to try to create a new replacement for the thing we already have, because the thing we already have has been inverted and is counterproductive at this point. So is there a political solution? I mean, if somebody runs with the will to achieve
right.
this, do you think that's possible here?
Well, I mean, we have to be careful with our terms when people say, like, you know, there is no political solution. Look, it's a political solution if a guy marches on D.C. and sets up a new regime. That's still a political solution. The question is whether it's an electoral solution. The question is whether there's a solution within the system. And I think what is probably going to happen in like a lot of these situations is it's going to be a bit of both. There's no scenario where you get like a regime change or some sweeping revolutionary thing that doesn't have an impact in the electoral system. These things kind of happen in fits and starts. There's going to be certain judges that are going to need to rule a certain way. There's going to need to be certain elected officials that vote a certain way to put a veneer of legality over the whole thing. Elections do still matter. But what I don't think anybody really believes at this point is that if you elect the right guy, he is capable of solving the problems.
Right.
I think Trump may have been the last gasp for this. And this is not a radical thing to say. Consider every single major left-wing triumph over the last 75 years has not come through winning elections. It's come from judges. It's come from lawsuits. It's coming through NGOs. It's come through non-electoral means. I mean, that's one of the great paradoxes here. The right, philosophically, tends to be a bit more skeptical of democracy. But we're the ones who have the masses on our side. Whereas the left, who won't shut up about our democracy, everything they've ever done has been decreed by unelected experts telling us what to do.
That's right.
And so it doesn't strike me as all that irrational that maybe that calculation should be reversed.
Yeah, that's actually a really great point. I'm just trying to run through in my mind now, like, okay, civil rights movement. Yeah, I mean, nobody ran and campaigned on doing that. It was protests and political pressure and propaganda campaign, and that's what brought about the change. So you're exactly right. So how would the right go about mimicking that strategy?
Well, I think one of the things that President Trump is being confronted with over and over again, you see voices on the right urging this, is they were always saying, cross the Rubicon, right? Mm-hmm. Don't go fishing in the Rubicon, cross the Rubicon. What does that mean in concrete terms? I think one of the most clear examples is where you have these judges. The Constitution, of course, never seems to matter when it comes to like defending our property, our liberty. The government is remarkably efficient, can do whatever it wants to us. But suddenly when it's time to deport an illegal immigrant, the Constitution really matters. Yep. The rule of law really matters. The rule of law actually exists to prevent illegal immigrants from being deported. At a certain point, one must recognize that the original constitutional intent is not that the judges get to set policy. And when judges are clearly overstepping their authority and saying you can't get rid of these people, at some point you just have to defy them and let the chips fall where they may. This has happened before. Andrew Jackson's portrait is in the Oval Office put there by Donald Trump. Maybe it's time to take the Jacksonian example. This is not a radical break with American tradition. Certainly, the man who has a giant memorial in Washington, D.C., Abraham Lincoln, was not known for his fidelity to constitutional niceties. The biggest problem with the constitutional regime, if you can even call it that, that we have now, I would say the Constitution hasn't mattered in a very long time, is fundamentally that the founders didn't expect that Congress, and to a lesser degree the president, would just put up with the judiciary asserting its own powers in this way.
Right.
There's no real check for it within the system besides impeachment. And I think they made a mistake in thinking that people would be so jealous of their own prerogatives and so jealous of their own powers that they wouldn't let judges do these kinds of things. But let's face it, the type of people who are in Congress are not there necessarily to get things done. I mean, what exactly has the Republican Congress done ever since President Trump's election? They're there to time serve. They're there to ultimately get a more lucrative job in the private sector. And increasingly, it seems that congressmen don't actually want to be congressmen. They want to be like us. They want to be influencers.
Yep. No, I think you're exactly right. And they seem – and I sort of get the calculus because not doing anything – is a smooth ride. That's a smooth sail right there. If you try to do something,
you don't get in trouble.
It goes badly and they're not going to like it, or it goes well and another group of people's not going to like it. So it is the better move if you're just a worm, you know, if you're a spineless scum like most people in office, of course you're not going to do anything. Man, we could go on and on. I wish we had more time. We really do have to set this up for a monthly at least appearance. Kevin, DeAnna, and of course, if you want to see more, you got to go follow Identity Politics on Rumble and Odyssey. You can follow him on X at VDareJamesK. Thank you so much for being here with us today, sir.
No, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
This has been absolutely great. Of course, you can go to amarin.com, VDareJamesK, Kevin DeAnna. He's using his real name now. It's time to really seize the moment. This is the Crucible, and we're going to come out of it one way or another. We're going to come out of it more extreme on the other side. I'd rather we be extreme in defense of our actual values, be extreme in defense of America and our people and our families and our heritage, not extreme in tearing it all down. That's what's being decided right now. Thanks for being here with us, folks.
Remember, you fund this operation. I'm very thankful to you, and I'm challenging you, those that have supported and love the products, and those that have never gotten the products, to do your Christmas shopping with us. If you get your orders in by Friday, you're guaranteed to get it way before Christmas anywhere in the United States. Okay, because we ship out like a day after the orders come in, and most of the country gets it in 2 days. The rest three, Hawaii or Alaska, I think it's like four. So get your orders in now. The biggest sale so far, 60% off on the ultramethylene blue, on the Shilajit, on the Irish sea moss, incredible super nutrient compounds that just blow you away. You owe it to yourself to get it. Our information's strong, you know that. The products are just as strong and just as powerful. I'm challenging you to support the broadcast. Those of you that have never gotten a supplement, go to the alexshilajit.com. Make the decision now. Get our ultramethylene blue. Get our Shilajit. Get our bovine colostrum. That's amazing. Experience it, and you're going to be hooked. and then we can continue on the air in a symbiotic relationship. But I need your help. Give yourself the gift of great health, clarity, and focus, and keeping powerful beacon of truth on the air, a 360 total win-win at thealexjonesstore.com. We also have limited edition fundraiser posters to keep us on the air at infowarsstore.com. I can't do this without you. You're not key, you're everything.
Well, hello there, Info Warriors. We are having a 60% off sale on selected items. Take a look behind me. We have the sea moss and Shilajit gummies. And you know, we have the medical grade methylene blue that will light your ass up like a Christmas tree. You can also buy one of me in the store. Act now while supplies last.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.